This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. In honor of Pride Month, we hear an interview from June 28, 2008 with humorist, comedian, diarist, and radio contributor David Sedaris, recorded in the KPFA studios while he was on tour for his collection of essays, When You Are Engulfed in Flames. David Sedaris, this collection, most of the pieces are from The New Yorker and Esquire, a couple other places, but there's a long, long piece, 80 pages, about quitting smoking. Did that appear anywhere?
It was cut to 10 pages for The New Yorker. My editor at The New Yorker, he snipped it down very efficiently, I thought. I would not have been able to do that as cleanly as he did. So there's only one story that didn't appear anywhere, Of Mice and Men. It was a story about storytelling, basically.
That's the one about the mouse running into the burning building?
Yes, the mouse in the burning building and the limo driver.
From what I read, you got your start when you were doing some kind of reading and in walked Ira Glass. What's the story behind that?
I used to live in Chicago, and there was a little scene, I suppose you could call it, of, you know, people would read out loud. It wasn't open mic. It was just, you know, somebody would say, oh, I'm curating an evening at this little tiny club, and would you come and read something? So I was reading, and Ira walked in and heard me, and we shook hands, and I was familiar with him because he was reporting on schools at that time for WBEZ and then for All Things Considered. So I was familiar with his name, and we shook hands, and then I moved to New York, and he called a couple of years later and asked if I had anything Christmassy that would work for a local show he had called The Wild Room, which was like a primitive version of This American Life. So I recorded the story of when I worked as an elf at Santaland, and he put it on his show, and then he put it on Morning Edition. And it basically, there was my life before Morning Edition ran on that morning, and then there was my life after. And they were completely different lives, completely different.
You had no expectations. I mean, what was the first sign that your life was going to completely turn around?
A telephone operator called me. And I didn't know they were allowed to make their own calls. It was a telephone operator, and she said, oh, I'm late for work, and it's your fault. I was in the parking lot, and I was listening to your story. The story ended, and then the phone rang. The phone rang, and you'd hang it up, and then it would ring again. And I'd never listened to Morning Edition. To me, the definition of a good life is being asleep when Morning Edition is on. All things considered, I'd listen to, but I had no idea how many people listened to Morning Edition. And then a couple editors called from publishing houses and said, do you have a book? And I did have a book. I was just waiting for someone to ask me for it. It was like a version of Barrel Fever. It was like half the stories in Barrel Fever and then half stories that never made it into the book that were just weren't, I suppose, they were just too primitive or whatever.
And you'd been writing all along then?
I started when I was 20, so I'd been writing for about 15 years.
What prompted you to start writing these essays then?
Well, I was writing fiction, and I'd been keeping a diary forever, but I was writing fiction, and then Ira put me on Morning Edition, and then they said, oh, can you be on Morning Edition some more? And the stories had to be true-ish, you know, because it never had occurred to me to write about my own life, you know. I mean, I did in a diary, and I would read things from my diary sometimes, but not higgledy-piggledy. You know, I'd take something and clean it up, but it was just a sideline. So really, it hadn't occurred to me. Like, if Ira hadn't put me on the radio, then I probably wouldn't have thought of writing what are called essays. I don't know, comic essays, I suppose you would call them.
Yeah, it's almost as if you started a genre. I mean, you didn't really, because people have been writing this kind of stuff for a long time, but then we've got the entire This American Life crew, you know, people like Sarah Vowell and David Rakoff and that whole crowd, and there's tons of them now.
Sarah and David are people who, I mean, I know both of them and I like them so, so much. To me, what they've got, though, is their, and I don't mean like to be putting myself down and then you say, oh, you do have a brain. Yeah, I don't mean that, but they're like really smart, you know? So I actually learn things when I read them. I laugh, but then I come away a better person because I've just learned something.
Whereas with your stuff, it's
well, you learn, like last night, I think I taught the audience a term. I met a flight attendant at a reading, and she told me that she and her fellow flight attendants, she said, you know how when you're on a plane sometimes and you have a plastic bottle of water, it'll get all crinkly, right?
Right.
She said, well, that happens to your insides too. And that's why we get all gassy on airplanes. She said, so what me and the other gals will sometimes do is pass gas while we walk up and down the aisle. She said, and the engine noise covers up the sound of it. But anyway, that's what we call crop dusting. I think everyone needs to know about crop dusting. So Sarah is where you'll go to learn about Abraham Lincoln, and David is where you'll go to learn about the history of thought, and I'm where you'll come to learn about crop dusting.
Well, not just crop dusting. Apparently, last night you also were giving people a survey on whether Barack Obama was circumcised.
You know, I thought the other day, I thought, is Barack Obama circumcised? I just wondered, right? So last night, I put a piece of paper on the signing table, and I said, circumcised, uncircumcised, which do you think? And it was interesting, because here I am in San Francisco. I would imagine, except for the teenagers, everyone in that room had gone to college. So do you think he's circumcised or not? And people would come up and say, well, he's Muslim, so I'm going to guess that he is. And someone else would come and say, well, he was born in Africa, so I'm going to guess that he's not. It was amazing the level of misunderstanding.
So what do you think?
I don't think he's circumcised. It's just a feeling that I have. When I picture him naked, I don't see him circumcised.
And you picture him naked?
When I do. You know, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm going to vote for him anyway. But it was just interesting to ask people. And I think what women did, I think women went with the penis they know. So whatever the last penis they saw, they decided that that would be Barack Obama's penis, where men were more, you know, you got to take his mom into consideration, right, who was kind of a free spirit. But she was a free spirit in, like, 1960. And during that time, it seems to me, you were just circumcised. I mean, they just did it. And you would want your child to fit in, I would think. During that time, I mean, now people say, oh, no, I don't want my son's foreskin mutilated. And it was different back then. So you would think he would be, but I don't think he was.
Well, my thought on it, and I don't want to get too far afield on this, of course, is that by 1964, when he was born, things were changing. And I think that the idea of the 1950s thing, it's like the other question would be, did he have a tonsillectomy? Because it would be the same kind of issue. In the 50s, everybody got them. By the 60s, they did not. 1964, probably not. So I'd agree with you on that.
It was an interesting survey to take. Most people thought that he was circumcised. But again, a lot of those were women, and they were going with the last penis they knew.
David Sedaris, apparently at one point there was going to be a film of Me Talk Pretty one day that Wayne Wang was going to do, and you decided to pull it on the grounds that it would really upset your family?
Well, no one in my family asked me not to do it. You know, they were all fine with it. But I wrote a story about telling my sister about it, right? And my sister said to me, will I have to be fat in the movie? And she said it in such a way that, you know, as if she had absolutely no choice in the matter. And I thought, when she said that, I thought, oh my goodness, what have I done? So I got out of the movie. And again, she didn't ask me to. I guess it hadn't occurred to me until that moment that somebody would actually be playing my brothers and sisters. And I liked Wayne very much. He's a lovely man, and I felt bad for disappointing him, but I should never have said yes in the first place.
So there's no possibility in the future, under similar circumstances, where, you know, Brad Pitt and Emil Hirsch play you and Hugh or something?
Somebody whose movies I've seen and I've really liked wanted to make a movie of Santaland. And the problem there is that I hate that Santaland story. It just
really?
Doesn't do a thing for me. And I think in order for it to work as a movie, you'd have to leave Santaland. You'd have to go out into the real world. So therefore, I'd have to concentrate on my life outside of there, outside of Santaland. And there were things going on in my life, but they all involved my family to some extent, too. So it would be dragging my family into it. And then somebody else just wanted to make a movie of a story called Child of God from Naked. And that's a story that just involves me and a man without any legs. And I would imagine that there are so many good actors out there who don't have legs who would just be like, yes, yes, finally, apart from me. So out of anything this is a new filmmaker, right? So I haven't seen anything he's made, but he offered to send me some student movies. So that tempts me more than anything. But I never wanted to be involved. I'm like the only person who never wanted to write a children's book and never wanted to write a screenplay.
You have two plays, though. One is two short plays, and then there's one that you did with your sister Amy.
Right. We did, I think, I don't know, like five or six plays. I don't even, play might be too strong a word, though. They were like silly shows. And David Rakoff directed one of them and was in several of them. And this woman who's on Broadway now, Jackie Hoffman, she was in the plays. And this very funny woman named Sarah Thayer and Amy. And, you know, no, there's no one better than Amy on stage. But I think those all worked because they were done at a certain moment. You know, they all belong to that little moment, and there's really kind of no going back to them. The plays were always written for specific people. Like, so I've never written a play thinking, oh, well, here's a play, and you go ahead and cast it however you like.
David Sedaris, this latest book, When You Were Engulfed in Flames, the title comes from something called Ingrish.
Yeah. You know, in France, and in any European country, you'll see little things like that, you know, but those are just mistakes, right? But in Japan, sometimes you would just have to ponder it. Like, I got these gift bags and they had a kitten on them, and the message on the bag was, only inflowing, you don't flowing, inflowing. That's something to ponder. It's like poetry.
The original title of this book was another one of those, something about beauty.
Oh, the original title was from a story that was in The New Yorker called... Okay. All the Beauty You Will Ever Need. I think that was my title. I don't know right. if that was The New Yorker's title. But then when I was in Japan, I was in Hiroshima, and I was in a hotel room, and there was a safety booklet in the room, and it said, Best Knowledge of Disaster Damage Prevention and Favors to Ask of You. And it was broken into three little paragraphs. When you check in a hotel, when you find a fire, and when you are engulfed in flames. And what I loved about that was that you would be engulfed in flames and you would think, damn it, what did that booklet say? What did that booklet say?
How did you meet Hugh?
I moved to New York in the fall of 1990, and I had an old friend from North Carolina. We'd met in 1977, and she was like a day laborer, and she got a job painting this guy's apartment, and I was going to help her, but we needed a ladder, and she knew a guy who had a ladder, and that turned out to be Hugh. So he was living in a loft on Canal Street, and I went with my friend Lily to get the ladder. And we walked up the stairs, and there was Hugh, and I thought, oh, that's going to be my boyfriend. I just sort of knew it at that moment. He was living with a couple, a woman named Leslie and her boyfriend Scott. And there was an apple pie in the oven, and country music was playing, and it was a Friday or Saturday night, and I thought, those are all really good signs. And I could have just moved into the house, the loft, just and not changed a thing. It was as if all of it was stuff I liked. I thought, there's nothing here I really need to change. All I have to do is convince him to fall in love with me. I needed a scheme, right? So I was having a sculpture exhibit in Chicago, and I had these sculptures that I'd been making. What I'd been doing was taking wind-up toys, and I would take the motor out, and I would encase them in wood, and I made these models of human hearts that would wind up and do different little awkward things. And so I called him, and I said, I want to put some kind of a finish on these, but I don't know what kind of finish. One of his jobs was as a decorative painter. So I got him to come over to my apartment and look at these things. Looking at the things was beside the point. I just wanted him.
It was like, come up to see my etchings.
Yeah, yeah. And then we went out to dinner. Then it took a while, you know, but like the second time that I was at his loft, I just hid notes. I hid them in his refrigerator. I hid them in his shoes. You will fall in love with David. What about David? How's about that David? They were in his drawers. You either scare somebody away that way, like really scare them away by going into their drawers the second time you go over to their house, or you endear yourself. So I just lucked out. And so we've been together for 17 years now.
This was before the whole This American Life thing.
Yeah, I had never been on the radio. I just moved to New York, so I'd never had anything published, you know, not in any place that anyone had ever heard of. I had a story coming out. Dennis Cooper had put together an anthology. And so I had a story that was coming out in that, and it was the first time I'd ever been in a book. But, you know, it was a small press. There was no reason why he would have thought that I would have paid off in any way.
At the point that suddenly the phone started to ring, were you guys living together at that point?
Yes. We met, and then we moved in together 5 or 6 months after we got together. We moved in together.
Was this around the time that you had the weird Helen?
Hugh had to get out of his loft, and I was living with a roommate, so I was kind of happy to move. So we were looking for an apartment. So Hugh was on Thompson Street in New York, and he was buying a cup of coffee. And there was this woman, he went to this shop, and it was owned by a Frenchman. who had like a deli and a butcher shop. Anyway, there was this woman there, and Hugh was asking if anybody knew of an apartment. And this woman told him to carry her groceries upstairs. And then on the way upstairs, she mentioned an apartment, and Hugh gave her some money, and we wound up getting the apartment. And her name was Helen.
Was that a real name?
Yes. When you write for The New Yorker, if you change someone's name, you have to acknowledge that you changed their name. But with Helen, you know, I couldn't think of anything else to change her name to. She was so Helen to me, and she was our neighbor for 7 years. So I wrote a story about her in the book. And I never want to write that I think someone's funny. I'd rather just quote them and let everyone see how funny that person is. So it was interesting to me when the book came out and people said, oh, why were you friends with that horrible person? And it's like, well, because she's really funny. I mean, she, if nothing else, you know, and she did some pretty mean things, but she was always funny.
What you're saying brings up about Helen's name brings up an interesting point, which is that The New Yorker does this outrageous fact-checking. And your stories are kind of true-ish, meaning that you sometimes will riff a little bit more. How do they deal with the fact that you do exaggeration when they have fact-checkers like that?
Well, I can't do, like, I can't get away with nearly as much as I'd like to. But, like, I wrote a story about spiders, right? Our house is overrun with spiders in Normandy, and so I'm constantly feeding the spiders. I'd written that my spiders got so fat that their feet tore holes in the webs. And the fact-checker called and said, well, I just spoke to an arachnologist, and that would never happen. And I said, well, I also say that their thighs were rubbing together. Like, that wouldn't happen either. They don't actually have thighs. Like, I think this is would qualify as something that's so ridiculous that we could get beyond it. And in that same story, I had written that I bought all these crickets to feed my spiders, and the crickets stink. And then she said, oh, I talked to an insect person, and only sick crickets stink. So apparently the crickets that I had were sick. But again, that was one of those things where I said, all right, maybe only sick crickets stink. But do I really? Please, please. So sometimes I can just, you know, you pick your battles. You know, another story, like I had mentioned a clock that my mother bought, and I said it was walnut, and they called my father, and my father said, that clock's cherry. So that's fine.
They called your father?
Yeah, to ask him about the clock. Was it really walnut? And my dad said it's cherry. So it's like, okay, fine, I'll just change it. You know, that's one of those things, you know, I just soon be right about. I wrote a story about a man in my village in Normandy who was imprisoned for sexually molesting his granddaughter. And the New Yorker got a fact checker who speaks French to call my neighbors, an 80-year-old sheep farmer and his wife who live across the road. Did Francis actually have a little, you know, truck? And my neighbor said, well, he did, but it was his brother's. They only let him drive it, you know, which is something I didn't know. But it wasn't about his truck. You know, I said that Francis owned a truck as small and quiet as a toy. So I just changed it to Francis drove a truck as small, you know. And then I had written that there was plastic in front of his house that was green and white. It wasn't white, it was milk colored. You know, when my neighbor, I didn't call them to say that a fact checker is going to be calling because that's a concept that doesn't, they wouldn't know what that meant. That would be like me saying somebody who milks hamsters is going to call you. Like, the, what? How? And I didn't want them to be feel set up in any way. But, you know, it made them feel very special to be asked. So they wanted to be as precise as possible. So when the fact checker presented me with everything that the Gerben said, it's like, oh, well, you know, I don't, I'm going to really fight for this and this and this, and then, okay, I'll go ahead and change this and this and this. But again, it wasn't what the story was about. He sexually molested his granddaughter. He went to prison for that. He died of cancer. His wife moved away. All of that stuff is exactly true. I went into his house on several occasions, right? He's dead now. So you're just going to have to take my word that I went into his house, and you're just going to have to take my word that he showed me his x-rays. I mean, my thinking is if I was going to make stuff up, I'd make up better stuff in that situation. It's interesting when a book comes out, let's say when my book comes out in Italy, I'll do interviews and people will say, now, how did you get the idea for this David character? And I would say, well, that's me. How did you decide that he would live in Raleigh, North Carolina? I'd say, well, that's where I lived. How did you come up with the mother? Well, that's my mother. And everything's called a novel. In France, it's called a novel. In Germany, it's called a novel. I mean, it's interesting here. I mean, I guess if you were going to get technical about it, then unless you have something on tape, you should never put anything in quotation marks. Because really, I mean, who remembers what was said to them when they were in third grade, much less last night? I mean, there were people who came through the line when I signed their books. I can recall a few conversations that I had with people, but can I honestly say that those were the exact words that those people used? No, I can't. If I were to write about it, I would call it nonfiction. Do I have a right to do that? I guess my thinking is that, like, there's a long and rich tradition of hyperbole in American humor writing, and I see absolutely no reason to mess with it.
I interviewed Augustine Burroughs not long ago, and he got a lot of flack on his recent book. You know, you were 6 years old. How can you quote your father? Things like that. And he's going, but wait a second. This is how I remember it.
I don't think there's a fact checker in all of England. I mean, when you read a newspaper in England, like I'd read in a newspaper in England that Alan Bennett had just won all of these Emmy Awards, and what he had won were Tony Awards. Just something like that. It's just a simple mistake, but it makes you look bad when you make mistakes like that. I don't want to make mistakes
right.
like that. But I think it's interesting that now there's that obsession in America. If you have to ask yourself why now, and I tend to think, and maybe it's just self-serving of me, but it seems to me like we live in a time when our government tells huge, huge lies, right? And so we're under the umbrella of this huge lie, and we're saying, you said you went to jail. In your book, you said you went to jail, and you didn't really go to jail. You know, Oprah didn't call George Bush a liar when he was on her show. You know, and those are lies that cost people their lives. So I wonder, like, under the shadow of huge lies, we're bickering about small lies, and I don't know how those two things are connected, but I think they are somehow. Everyone's got their own idea of what's okay. I did an interview in Boston a few weeks ago, a public radio interview, right? And they're having a fundraiser. And I said to the woman, before we go on, I said, why don't I give you $500? And then we'll talk on air about how incredibly generous I am. And then maybe it'll get other people to donate money, right? And she said, oh, that sounds good. We'll do that later. So the interview starts, and she said, spotlight on my guest. Okay, David Sedaris. It's been alleged that not everything you write is exactly true, is it? You know, she was like really aggressive, and we have this conversation that goes on for like half an hour, and then that's over with, and then we tape the bit, and she says, oh, David Sedaris, you just gave me $500, you know, that's so nice of you. And I said, well, I'm incredibly generous, and one of these days I got to start thinking about myself, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, whole thing's over, and then I said to her, okay, I'm going to go give that $500. Oh, you don't need to do that. It's like, okay, wait a minute. So you just grilled me for half an hour about not telling the truth, but it's okay? You know, you just thanked me in front of all these listeners for giving you the money, but now it's okay if I don't? Like, why is your lie fine? You know, but I think everybody's got their own little, you know, you lie to save someone's feelings, you lie to, if Hugh and I both witnessed something, Hugh's version would be incredibly accurate. Right, there were four people. It was a man and a woman and a girl who looked more like the woman than the man. Okay, and then next to them was a boy, and maybe he was a teenager, but if he was a teenager, I would say that he was like 17 years old. But he could have been adopted because his hair was a different color. Then, and the four of them were in the car, but the mother and the. Do you mean? Like if you were in court,
yeah, right.
If you were in court, you would want Hugh's version of the story. My version of the story, I'm going to cut to the chase and I'm going to make it as entertaining as possible. That's the way I am in life when I talk, and that's the way I am in paper on paper when I write. I've never presented myself as a reporter. I've never applied for a job as a reporter. I've always been very upfront about the way that I write, and I feel almost like it's if I were to say to people, I dye my hair. I dye my hair. I dye my hair. I dye my hair. And then all of a sudden it's, isn't it true that you dye your hair? It's like, yeah, well, I told you. Well, shouldn't you have told us before that you dyed your hair? Well, I did tell you. Shouldn't you wear on your shirt a sign that says, I dye my hair? It's like, what are you so upset about? I don't dye my hair.
I do.
Do you really?
Yeah. My hair would be white.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I never, unless someone's hair is like a bright color, or unless it doesn't really match their skin, it never occurs to me that people dye their hair.
So you quit smoking, and I quit when I was like 23, and I never went back, and you quit at, how old were you then?
I had just turned 50, and now I'm 51, and I haven't had a cigarette in a year and a half.
And how does it feel?
You know, it's interesting to me how quickly you feel better. I mean, I smoked a lot. I would have chest pains, or I just could be worn out easily, right? And it was just interesting to me. Like, I started swimming after I quit smoking. And, you know, I'm never going to be very good at it, but it's the kind of thing I couldn't even make it across the pool when I very first started. Hugh can swim back and forth and back and forth for 45 minutes without stopping, and I have to cling to that wall every time I get to it. I'm probably never going to get better, but it's something I never could have done. I don't even care about that. Like, I sort of hate it when people quit smoking. And the only reason I quit was so I could stay in nice hotels again. All the decent hotels went non-smoking, and I travel 2 months out of the year. I can travel for 2 months out of the year. I can go to a different city every day. You can make me a schedule, and I can do everything on that schedule. I don't care how much you put on there. I can do all of that. I can get 3 hours of sleep a night, but I need to stay at the Ritz-Carlton.
I never really got the sense of why, to quit smoking, you moved to Japan for 3 months. I mean...
Well, I'd read in a book that the best way to quit was to either move your furniture or move. And I'd gone to Tokyo for 3 days, and I absolutely loved it. And so I thought, well, if nothing else, this will be an excuse to go back. Plus, in Tokyo, you can't smoke on the street, or you have to go to an outdoor special smoking station. You can't just walk on the sidewalk and smoke. So I thought that might help, too, because it's the opposite of everywhere else. And I think it's a lot smarter than everywhere else. In America, we say, you go outside if you want that cigarette, and you walk 20, you walk 30, you walk 50 feet from the door. No one's making any money. And in Japan, they say, if you want to smoke that cigarette, you have to go into that restaurant. You have to go into that bar. You have to go into that coffee shop. You have to go into your office. So you got to go somewhere that involves either making money or spending money. And it's much smarter than the way that we do it.
You think if you had stayed in Normandy or Paris, you have a place in both, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you had stayed in Normandy or Paris, it would have been impossible for you to quit?
Not impossible, but if I were to say, all right, at midnight on January 2nd, I'm having my last cigarette. I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I won't be a smoker. I wouldn't have been able to get to sleep that night because I would be thinking about how horrible the next day was going to be. And I would have sat at my desk for a minute and a half and I would have said, this is ridiculous, give me a cigarette. But this way, it took me so long just to get to Japan, and then the time was all out of whack, and then all of a sudden I'm in this apartment, and I've never been in this apartment before, and I look out the window and I'm in a high rise, and there's Tokyo Tower and there's Mount Fuji, and I'm sitting at my desk and it's a dining room table, and I've never owned a table like this, and I would never want to own a table like this. And it was hard to write, but my editor at the New Yorker told me, everyone's quit smoking, you're not the first one, and everyone's gone through this, you're not special in any way, you'll just get over it, it might take a while, but you'll get over it. And that's what happened. Tokyo smells like raw sewage to me a lot, so I noticed that. And I was eating food that I'd never eaten before. So it would have been different if I was eating the same thing, like the chickens in France are more flavorful than they are in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
But if I'd been eating French chicken the whole time, I think it would have been like turning up the volume, right? That I could taste it better and better and better. But all of a sudden, I was eating food that I'd never even eaten sushi before I went to Japan. So I'm eating all this stuff that's completely new to me. So I couldn't compare the taste to how it might have tasted earlier.
Well, what happened when you got home? Do you have any recollection of there being a difference then?
If so, I think with smell, yes, more than taste. But I'm more like a dog when it comes to eating, right? So if you threw me a battery, I'd probably eat it. I'd catch it in my mouth and I'd eat it. I'm more of a quantity eater. I'm not really one to savor and appreciate it. I'm just thinking, how much of this can I get? Even if I don't like it, I'm thinking, how much of this can... And I think it comes from growing up in a big family. I'm always sure that I'm not going to get enough food. Always sure.
So how did you maintain your thinness?
I let myself gain as much weight as I needed to for a year. And then I went on a diet. I mean, I think I understood early on that eating's not a substitute for smoking. That was another good reason for going to Tokyo, because how much weight are you going to gain eating raw fish?
David Sedaris, about what percentage of your actual stories that you publish in the magazines wind up in these books? Do all of them? 80%? What do you think?
Since the last book came out, There were two, I think, New Yorker stories that I didn't put in this book just because they didn't seem to fit. They didn't seem right for it. Oh, there are a bunch of things that I've had on This American Life, but I've been writing. Those are fictional stories. I'd like to call them fables, but the morals are a little bit fuzzy. Those will be their own book at some point. Like, there was a story I wrote in The New Yorker. They did a food issue, and they wanted me to write something, and so I did. And I thought, at the time that I gave it to them, I thought, oh, I'm happy with this. But then I read it out loud, and I realized, oh, this doesn't... I wish that I had had a chance to read it out loud before I had it published, because I would have learned. Most of the stories in the book, when I go on these lecture tours, like I'm going on one in October, right? So I already have like six new stories. So I'll read something out loud and go back to the hotel and rewrite it and read it and rewrite it. And I consider myself very fortunate to be able to edit and learn in front of an audience. And I actually don't like it when a story is published before I have a chance to learn in front of an audience.
Well, that's no different than what playwrights do.
Right. So it's like a tryout in Peoria. I just like to learn as much as I can on my own before I give it to my editor.
What happens when you're in France for long periods of time?
I mean, I always go on a lecture tour every fall and every spring. I didn't go on one last spring because I had the book tour in June. Usually every 5 months or so, I walk out the door with a bunch of new stuff and see if it's going to work. And sometimes it takes a while to learn how to read something. Like I read something last night when I was at the bookstore, and it was just 2 pages long, and it's something I wrote right after I turned the book in. And I felt very free, and it didn't have to be anything. You know, when I gave it to my editor as a possible Shouts and Murmurs for The New Yorker, and they didn't take it. And I read it last week, and I thought, okay, well, that's just stupid, and it's no good, and I should throw it away. And then a couple of days later, I thought, you know, I'm going to give that a try. But what if I read it like this? So it was one of those things that perhaps on paper it doesn't work, but out loud, it's growing. You know, I mean, I'm learning how to make it work.
And eventually it will be something you could put in print.
Maybe, or maybe I would just put it on a CD, because maybe if it's taken me a long time to learn how to make it work with my voice, then maybe it's one of those things that doesn't work on paper, and it needs my voice to make it work. And so in that case, you know, I'm going to do a reading, I think, at Lincoln Center, and they want to turn it into a CD. So maybe I'll read it at Lincoln Center, and it'll just exist as an audio thing, and it will never appear in print.
David Sedaris, have you ever thought of writing actually a novel?
I signed a contract saying that I would write a novel, but I don't know how to write a novel. I read novels, and I think, how on earth did this person pull this off? So I thought about maybe taking a class on how to write a novel and writing one that way. I mean, why not? I mean, other people do it. I have a 10-page attention span, right? So after 10 pages, I'm just bored to death with something. So obviously my chapters would have to be 10 pages and less. But other people do it. Like when you look at one of those adventure novels, often the chapters are like, I don't know, 3 pages long. I don't know, they make it work. So I don't know why I couldn't. Another thing I thought of was, what if you went to the library and you checked out a book that, let's say, a book that was written in the 40s or 50s or, you know, any time earlier. And you said, this is my model. I'm going to rewrite this book, but I'm going to make it funny. And that doesn't mean that I'm going to necessarily give the characters these same names. It doesn't mean that they're going to live in this exact same town. But I'm going to use this as my model. I will credit it as my model. I will either pay the person who wrote it or pay their family or pay their publisher. You know, work out the money thing so that nobody's sore about it, and write a novel that way.
David Sedaris, now you publish this. Do you have another? You have another collection of different things coming out soon, or what?
I have a collection of those little animal stories that I've been writing, and I think that's gonna come out next. I'm supposed to turn that in next year, and then I have to write 2 more books, and one of them's supposed to be a novel. But if it's not a novel, I think they'll probably forgive me. Yeah, so I have to write 2 more books, and I'm 51. You know, when you have a contract like that, they tell you when you're supposed to turn the new books in, but, you know, I really lucked out publisher-wise. My publisher's great. So if I need a bit more time, they always give it to me.
David Sedaris, quick political question. You guys planning to get married now that you can in California?
No, we're just not the marrying type. You know, we're the type to live together, but I would sign a piece of paper that would save me. If you put a contract in front of me and said, if you sign this, you'll save 12 cents, I would sign it. I would do that to save money on, right now in France, if I were to die, he would have to pay, I think, 60% inheritance tax on the apartment. But if we were Pax-aid, if we had a civil union, that would be reduced to 30%. So I'll do that. Maybe if I liked jewelry more, or if I needed a toaster or something, I would get married. But I don't need those things.
In France, do people make fun of George W. Bush as much as they do, say, in Berkeley?
Yeah, but then they woke up one day and Carla Bruni was their first lady. So it's been a shock to the French system.
And they're big Obama supporters, I suspect.
Yeah. No one in France has ever, blamed me for George Bush. They've been curious, and they've said, I don't understand. Can you explain this to me? And I wish that I could, you know. But, you know, they're very excited about – the people I know in France are very excited about Barack Obama. And, of course, they are. You know, he's a good-looking guy. Circumcised or not, he's a good-looking guy.
You've been listening to an interview with David Sedaris, recorded June 28th. 2008, while he was in the KPFA studios on tour for his collection, When You Are Engulfed in Flames. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky radio shows on Facebook.